to reimagine a culture buried by imperial history for centuries. Tickets at AsianArt.org.
There's a nasty illness spread by ticks that's on the rise in the Northeast and Midwest United States.
It does seem to be following the trend of Lyme disease and entering into areas where Lyme disease is prevalent.
But scientists are on the case. They're starting clinical trials to come up with a treatment. Learn more Monday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition comes your way at 2 a.m. every weekday morning, and then, of course, 5 a.m. on the weekends. I'm Beth Eisinger. Coming up, Natalia Navarro with KQED News, and you'll learn about how UC Davis researchers are teaching people how to better prepare for wildfire and other natural disasters through a board game. That story and more coming up after the NPR News update. The producers, reporters, and hosts of KQED Public Radio are represented by the Screen Actors Guild, American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, AFL-CIO. This is KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highlands Sacramento. We're live online at KQED.org and always on the KQED app. It's 7 o'clock.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. Israel rescued four hostages held by Hamas on Saturday. The Israeli military operation killed hundreds of people. We have the latest. And all eyes are on WNBA star Caitlin Clark, but her arrival to the league has been bumpy. Plus, what's in a name? We take a look at music's most famous and sometimes infamous alter egos.
He didn't want to just sound like one guy. He wanted to try his hand at a different style of music that interested him. But there's
something about it's Sunday, June 9th. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. President Biden today closes out his trip to France by paying his respects at an American military cemetery that Donald Trump had notably skipped visiting when he was president. It's a final punctuation to President Biden's extended trip to France, beginning with a tribute to the 80th anniversary of the D-Day invasion of Normandy and a salute to the soldiers who fought and those who fell there. Tens of millions across the European Union have been voting in EU parliamentary elections in a massive exercise of democracy. From Brussels, Terry Schultz reports there's expected to be a far-right surge in support among the more than 370 million people eligible to cast ballots.
The 720 candidates who win seats in the next five-year term of the European Parliament already have huge issues on their agenda, including continuing assistance to Ukraine and sanctioning Russia, legislating environmental policies to fulfill the EU's Green Deal pledge of making the bloc carbon neutral by the year 2050, and trying to help increasingly agitated farmers sustain their livelihoods. Migration policy is controversial across Europe. The ongoing influx of people seeking a better life is one reason for increased support for far-right parties, which pledge to keep migrants out and send those who are here back to their home countries. Results from all 27 EU countries will be known early Monday. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Supreme Court watchers are getting ready to hear from the nation's top justices on several major cases. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
If you look at the numbers as to which justices have written the most and which justices have written the fewest number of opinions, you can see that the two more senior liberal justices have written the most, meaning they may not have many more majority opinions to write, only dissents. And the court's conservatives have written the fewest, meaning that they likely have lots more majority opinions getting ready to drop, especially the Chief Justice.
NPR's Nina Totenberg. Workers have authorized a strike at one of the world's most prominent scientific journals. NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports.
Employees voted overwhelmingly to strike at the scientific publisher Springer Nature. The journal Nature and its sister publications are among the most well-respected in all of science. Papers are reviewed by editors with PhDs in their field, and having a study accepted can make a researcher's career. But Nature's employees say pay has not kept up with the UK's high rate of inflation in recent years. Meanwhile, they say Springer Nature has posted hundreds of millions millions of dollars in profit. If the staff walks out later this month, it would be the first labor disruption to Nature's publication schedule in its 155-year history. Jeff Brumfiel, NPR News.
This is NPR News in Washington.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. A research team led by a UC Davis professor is teaching people how to better prepare for wildfire and other natural disasters through a board game. KQED's Catherine Monahan reports.
Dozens of people are gathered over maps of the town of Tamaulipas in Marin County. And in this game, the map is the board.
So the fire is here. Yeah. May I have a flame?
Well, let's see. It's a medium fire. So let's put a medium one down.
The first step is to use a spinner to create an imaginary fire somewhere on the board. People play as themselves, so they start where they would be in real life, and their game piece represents the vehicle that they would actually use to evacuate. Tom Mayorana, a researcher at UC Davis, is the game designer.
Wildfires are this, you know, existential threat for so many Californians, yet it's one of those things that so few of us actually get to practice how we respond to it.
The idea, says Mayorana, is for people to think through an evacuation before they have to do it for real. And that's particularly important in tiny coastal Tamaulipas, which has only 3 roads in and out of town and is 18 miles from the nearest gas station.
If your tank is less than full, skip the turn.
But see, that's a classic opportunity for us to learn to fill up our tanks.
After the game, residents talk through what they've learned and come up with ideas for how they can better prepare. The research team hopes to play with other California communities in the future. In Tamales, I'm Catherine Monahan, KQED News.
And I'm Natalia Navarro.
Support comes from Paint Care. Leftover paint can be dropped off and recycled at nearly 800 sites in California. PaintCare.org. Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at WTGrantFoundation.org. And the listeners and supporters and members of KQED Public Radio. Sunshine in the forecast today after morning clouds, and we hear some of the high temperatures and still winds out of the west up to about 20 miles per hour once again expected this afternoon. 66 degrees expected for a high in San Francisco, 71 in Oakland, 79 in San Jose, 89 in San Jose, 88 expected for a high in Sonoma County, and 79 in the Napa Valley.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. 4 Israeli hostages are home. Cheers erupted on a beach in Israel as the lifeguard announced the news that Israeli special forces rescued the hostages from Gaza on Saturday. It was the biggest hostage rescue raid of the Israel-Hamas war, and also one of the bloodiest Israeli operations of the war. NPR's producer, Anas Baba, was nearby and ran for cover with other Palestinians. Gaza's health ministry says at least 274 people were killed and 698 wounded. NPR's Daniel Estrin joins us from Tel Aviv, and a warning that this reporting will include graphic descriptions of violence. Good morning.
Good morning, Aisha.
So, Daniel, tell us more about the hostage rescue.
It took place at 11:30 in the morning on Saturday. It was a raid by Israeli Special Operations Forces on 2 residential apartment buildings in central Gaza. One of the buildings held a 26-year-old Israeli woman, and the other building held 3 Israeli male hostages. They were all held in locked rooms in apartment buildings, and there was a gun battle with their Palestinian guards when the Israeli officers came to rescue them. One of the Israeli officers was killed in that gun battle. The officers then left the building with the hostages that came under heavy Palestinian fire, and they left Gaza by helicopter from the Mediterranean shore. This was an operation that they had practiced for weeks using models of the apartment buildings, and they carried out this raid in broad daylight for that element of surprise. All these details were given to reporters by the army spokesman, who acknowledged that there were high Palestinian casualties in this raid, he blamed Hamas for holding hostages among civilians.
Who were the hostages that were rescued?
Well, they were all captured on October 7th when Hamas launched this war. They were captured from the Nova Music Festival. One of the most well-known of them was 26-year-old Noah Argemani. She was filmed as she was being taken on a motorcycle by Hamas into Gaza. She was calling out for help. Her mother, who was born in China, is hospitalized in Israel with advanced cancer, and she had been pleading to see her daughter while she is still alive. Two other security guards who were working at the festival were captured that day and rescued yesterday. One of them was a recent immigrant from Russia, and his parents flew to Israel to see him when he was rescued. So you just see some of the diverse backgrounds of the families touched by this. One 22-year-old Israeli man who was rescued, his father actually died hours before he was rescued, and so he didn't live long enough to hear the news that his own son was freed.
Tell us about the hostage operation from the perspective of Palestinians in Gaza.
Well, it really is a split-screen reality because for Israel, this was a massive triumph, a moment of celebration. For Palestinians, it was a tragedy. This was a complete surprise for Palestinians. NPR producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, was there on the scene, and he took cover with residents at a United Nations school. There was heavy fire, and no one really knew what was going on.
Artillery everywhere, airstrikes everywhere. We don't know exactly what's happening here. People are only trying to get inside of the school in order to take a shelter.
And then he went back to the scene of the hostage raid and interviewed some eyewitnesses in the neighborhood who, one of them, Ahmad, said that he saw it take place on it was a busy street in the middle of the day in the Nusayrat refugee camp. He said that he saw a truck come in, and then he said special forces that appeared to be dressed as Hamas militants came out, put a ladder on the house, one of the houses, and entered. He saw helicopters shooting, there were drones hovering between the homes, and then minutes later, the forces sped away under heavy air fire. And he said that he and many residents fled at that moment, and when they returned home, they found 10 or 15 homes damaged or destroyed and lots of bodies. He said he returned home to see bodies everywhere and aircraft still firing on people. There was blood everywhere. He said the situation was extremely tragic.
Does this hostage rescue and the large number of casualties have the potential to change the course of the war?
Well, it does not mean that we should expect to see many more hostage rescue raids like this one. The Israeli army's spokesman has said that the only way to bring out most of the hostages still in Gaza is by striking a deal with Hamas.
And what does all of this mean for embattled Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu?
This rescue raid did give Netanyahu an image of victory, but it does come at a fraught time for him because of divisions in his government and pressure at home about the remaining hostages and the war still going on. I don't think it changes the bigger picture for him. The war still has no clear exit. And that remains unchanged despite this dramatic hostage rescue raid.
NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I stand here today as the first president to come to Point d'Hoc when none of those 225 brave men who scaled this cliff on D-Day are still alive. None.
President Biden returns from France today after a visit to a cemetery outside Paris to honor World War I fighters. And that's after a state visit with French President Emmanuel Macron yesterday and the Friday ceremony on the Normandy coast in which he recalled those 225 World War II Army Rangers.
They ask us, what will we do? They're not asking us to scale these cliffs, but they're asking us to stay true to what America stands for.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson joins us now. Good morning, Mara.
Good morning, Aisha.
What stood out to you from this trip?
What stood out to me was the implicit criticism of Donald Trump in Biden's speeches in Europe. He made a strong defense of democracy. He framed the choice facing the West today as democracy versus dictatorship. He went to the same cemetery in France that President Trump had skipped a visit to in 2018. Reportedly, Trump said at the time that the people who were buried there were suckers and losers. Later, his former chief of staff, John Kelly, confirmed that. So he's trying to make an implicit contrast with Trump, who's had more warm words for Vladimir Putin than he has for our NATO allies. Trump famously said that Putin should go ahead and do whatever he wants in Europe, and the U.S. wouldn't come to the aid of NATO allies unless they paid more. You know, Biden went on to say in his speech that isolationism was not the answer 80 years ago, and it's not the answer today. I mean, he's clearly trying to frame this election as a choice between democracy and authoritarianism and isolationism.
I was on that 2018 trip where we skipped the cemetery. I remember what a big deal that was. But there's another big contrast that's happening at the moment, right? And it's happening in courtrooms.
That's right. Trump was found guilty on May 31st, and now the president's son, Hunter Biden, is currently on trial for gun charges. But there's been a huge difference between the way these two candidates have approached these trials. Trump's strategy has been to undermine faith in the justice system. He's relentlessly attacked the judge and the system as unfair and rigged. Some of his supporters have called for jailing the prosecutor in the case, Alvin Bragg. On the other hand, Joe Biden has vowed not to pardon his son, even if he's found guilty. He hasn't made any attacks on the judge or the legal system. He says he will accept the verdict, and he really does believe in the system, and that's another big contrast that he's making with Trump in this election, that Trump wants to undermine democratic institutions and Biden wants to preserve and strengthen them. The other point that Biden's Democratic allies are making in answer to Trump's argument that somehow the justice system is weaponized against him is that Biden's Department of Justice is currently not only prosecuting the president's son, but they're also prosecuting Democratic Senator Bob Menendez and Democratic Representative Henry Cuellar.
Trump is vowing revenge. Is Project 2025 a part of that, or the Washington Post reporting on what the headline calls a, quote, post-constitutional second term?
Well, what really strikes me is how openly Trump is running on an authoritarian platform. He wants to expand the powers of the executive, get rid of some of the checks and balances on the president. He's asking the Supreme Court to say that the president is immune from prosecution. He opened his campaign by saying, "I'm your retribution." He has openly promised revenge against his enemies. He wants to make the civil service more political, deprofessionalize the civil service. He's doing this quite openly.
Circling back to Trump's convictions in state court in Manhattan, it's been about a week and some change. Is there any fresh indication of how voters are feeling about it?
We have a bunch of polls now that show majorities of independents and swing voters think the guilty verdict was correct. It hasn't changed the race very much, but may have around the edges. We see that low information voters, and a lot of them are young people, people that have been drifting away from Joe Biden, and he really needs to get them back. Many of them say that they approve of the verdict. People have a short attention span. We don't know what's going to happen over time. Will people forget about this verdict and the race will go back to where it was before and where it's been for quite a while, which is a very close race with Trump having an edge in the battleground states. But one thing that the conviction might have done is it helped Biden do something that he's struggled with for months. He spent tens of millions of dollars trying to make this a choice election rather than a referendum on him. And the verdict makes it a little easier for him to make that argument, to say that Trump only cares about himself and revenging himself and not you. On the other hand, this also has helped Trump because it's fired up his base. They were pretty fired up already, but he's been able to raise tremendous amounts of money after the verdict, closing the funding gap between him and the president.
That's NPR's Mara Liasson. Mara, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from VisitorsCoverage.com, offering both inbound U.S. and outbound U.S. travel, medical, and trip insurance, so travelers are covered for financial risks and medical emergencies wherever they go. Learn more at visitorscoverage.com. And Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, still family-owned, operated, and argued over. Listeners can explore their brews wherever fine beverages are sold and learn how trailblazing runs in the family by visiting sierranevada.com.
During the pandemic, the federal government spent hundreds of billions of dollars to curb learning loss. With that funding now coming to an end, some educators are concerned.
They're worried that a kid who might have benefited from an after-school program that focused on catching them up on math, that that's going away when they're still behind.
What happens next in schools? That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered, that's this afternoon at 5 p.m. here on KQED Public Radio.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. Israelis this weekend are celebrating the rescue of four hostages taken by Hamas last October in a bloody raid inside Israel. The death toll among Palestinians after the rescue operation has risen to 274, with more than 700 injured, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. Millions of voters across 27 countries are wrapping up 4 days of voting in the European Parliament elections. France and Germany, the EU's most populous countries, are voting today. 20-year-old American Coco Gauff has won her first Grand Slam doubles title at the French Open in Paris. Gauff, who won the U.S. Open women's single title last year, teamed with Katerina Siniaková of the Czech Republic. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from your part-time controller. U.S.-based staff helping nonprofits with their accounting, from bookkeeping, that is, to financial reporting and analysis, to CFO services. YPTC.com/NPR. And Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate, at Progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And the listeners and supporters and members of KQED Public Radio. The time now, 7:21.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. President Biden is now restricting most asylum claims at the southern border. His executive actions call for those restrictions when unauthorized crossings exceed an average of 2,500 migrants for 7 consecutive days. That means a migrant who might otherwise apply for asylum, for example, because they fear for their lives in their home country, have a choice. Wait for the numbers to go down and restrictions to be lifted, or attempt to enter the U.S. illegally and risk deportation. That's the situation member station WKAR's Michelle Jokish-Polo found at the border.
Diana, her 2, 5, and 8-year-old children, her father and her teenage brother, David, arrived at Ciudad Juarez on Tuesday. But their eyes were on El Paso, Texas, just across from the Rio Grande border, where they were planning to petition asylum. The family asked NPR to not use their last names because they feared speaking out could jeopardize their claim. They were tired after completing a 3-month journey from their native Venezuela. Then they got the news. People crossing the border illegally are not allowed to petition for asylum, but the measures allow those with an appointment through the government's mobile app to be considered for asylum. It cost us a lot to get here, says Diana. Her brother David says they were really excited at first when they heard that the border was nearby. But when they got there, they were told that it was closed. He says they were disappointed. As soon as they got off the bus in Juarez, in 90-degree weather, the family walked straight to the border to turn themselves in and petition for asylum. Instead of going through a point of entry, they opted to cross the Rio Grande by foot. They didn't use the CBP1 app to make an appointment. Border Patrol agents immediately pushed them back into Mexico. That's not what they were expecting. False information on TikTok and other messaging platforms gives some people the impression that all immigrants need to do is show up at the border and they're allowed in with a pending court date. Neither by bus, taxi, or train, they won't let us in, Diana says. Defeated, hungry, and tired, the family set out to find shelter. There was no celebration for her 29th birthday, but they found respite at a city shelter next to an international bridge. There, the family got food, water, and a place to sleep. People from other countries were staying at the shelter as well, with similar hopes and dreams. Diana says right now there's a large group of people staying at the shelter, with many coming from Ecuador, Colombia, and El Salvador. The 2,200-mile journey for this family had a destination, Florida. That's where Diana's husband is. Unable to find a job in Venezuela, he petitioned asylum nearly 9 months ago through the same border area, but before the new restrictions were in place. For NPR News, I'm Michelle Yokishpolo in El Paso.
When two struggling teams in a pro sports league play each other, it can be a tough sell, except this year in the WNBA. 20,000 fans turned out for last Friday's game between the Indiana Fever and the Washington Mystics. For the sold-out crowd here in Washington, D.C., a huge draw was rookie phenom Caitlin Clark. And longtime NPR staffer and now the network's new sports correspondent Becky Sullivan was in the crowd. Becky, congrats on the new gig.
Thank you.
So, Caitlin Clark, she's talked about as possibly the best women's college basketball player ever. Mm-hmm. How's the transition to the pros going?
You know, so the season, the WNBA season started just over, just under a month ago, and Clark actually struggled at first. She had 10 turnovers in her first game. Turnovers have continued to be a problem. She leads the league in turnovers. And then at first, also, she was struggling to hit three-pointers, which is really her sort of signature game in college. But at this Friday night game, that came after a couple days of rest for Clark's Indiana Fever team, and that made all of the difference, apparently. She hit 30 points. It's a high for her. 8 rebounds, 6 assists, hit more than half her shots. It was a great game by any measure.
So why had she been struggling?
I think a big part of the reason is that there is this very quick turnaround from college basketball in the WNBA, you know, whereas men coming from college, they have like the benefit of this long offseason because the NBA doesn't start until October. The WNBA, you know, the draft was only 1 week after the college championship game, which Clark played in. The regular season started just about a month after that. And the Fever, her team, had lots of games in quick succession. And so, you know, Clark was talking about this on Friday night, and she was basically like, that's part of it.
All of us would say, like, that's just not ideal. It's not an ideal way to play basketball. I think you could see the exhaustion on our faces more mentally than probably physically. Obviously, physically, we're exhausted, but I think mentally it's hard to stay sharp in those moments when you're going game to game.
So what's the reaction been from fans?
You know, despite her struggles, there has been so much enthusiasm. And on Friday night, that was like really felt as she was just hitting three after three after three in the third quarter. The Mystics, the Washington Mystics, who were the home team in this situation, they don't normally play in this big Capital One arena. Usually they play in a small venue that seats about 4,000 people. But they moved this game because of all the interest in Clark and the Fever and the WNBA this season. It sold out. 20,000 people, more than 20,000 people went. That's more than went to game one of the NBA Finals. This past week, just for comparison's purpose. So the stands are packed, people of all ages. You got kids, adults, men, women, boys and girls, a lot of them out wearing Caitlin Clark gear. And not all of them were veteran fans of the WNBA, of course. And so I talked to a few people in the crowd. Among them were Jason Smith and his 9-year-old daughter, Autumn, who live in Virginia. They had never watched the WNBA before this year. This was their first ever game in person. And they, you know, Jason told me that they came because of Caitlin Clark.
We've been following her for like the last 2 years, and the opportunity came up this year, so the two of us headed into the city.
And I asked his daughter, Autumn, what she likes about Clark.
Her three-point shots and like her really good passes to people.
I mean, this is like a 9-year-old girl who's like super dialed in, knows Clark's game. The family is watching games together, not just this one night in person, but together at home. They said they're following 4 teams. That's exactly what the league is hoping for, and they're cashing in already on that this season.
Well, that is so cute. But so there has been some drama, though, around Caitlin
yes.
Clark this weekend, and there's reporting that she apparently won't be on the roster for Team USA for the Paris Olympics next month. What's going on?
Yeah, you know, part of this reporting came out this weekend. Part of it is that there was a training camp held for the U.S. Olympic team that was held this spring that Caitlin Clark couldn't attend because of March Madness. She was still in college, still playing in that. And, you know, even if there is one thing that I think a reaction that a lot of people have had is that even if there is confidence in getting a gold medal without Clark on the team, you do have to wonder, you know, here's this name. She's drawing so many people to the women's games. She's helping to sell out arenas. She's just generating all this enthusiasm and excitement around women's basketball. Like, kind of, why wouldn't she want someone like that to go represent your country? On the other hand, let's be honest, there's tons of really great players in women's basketball in the U.S. who are reported to be on the roster. That includes A.J. Wilson, Breonna Stewart, Brittany Griner, several more. Women's basketball hasn't lost a game. The U.S. hasn't lost a game at the Olympics since 1992. So I think we'll see what happens.
NPR's Becky Sullivan, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
I'm going to be honest with y'all. When I'm not working, I do like to try to relax and zone out and just game.
Okay, wait.
I do it on the weekends with my kids.
I won.
And at night, after I put the kids to bed, I fire up the Nintendo Switch. And it's just me and Princess Peach.
Oh, my goodness.
In the game, we're in this theater that's been taken over by these bad, dark entities, and she's using her power, the power of Sparkle, to fight the bad guys and make the world a little bit brighter.
I don't know about that one. That was tough.
I love it. And I'm not alone. Video games are a national pastime. One report estimated that 65% of Americans play video games. But for a long time, there was a whole part of the population that couldn't easily play video games. People with disabilities. That's starting to change, as NPR's The Indicator podcast has reported. Indicator co-host Waylon Wong joins us now.
Thank you so much. Have you gotten to Sherlock, Princess Peach? Oh, it's so cute.
No, I love the ninja where she hides behind the wall to blend in, and it's like camouflage.
It's
and you
really
just go
cute.
To the wall.
Yeah.
They put a lot of work into that.
Yeah, they did.
So Waylon, one of the things you all looked at was the untapped market of the disabled community. And this is the third trend that you explored. Is the gaming industry becoming more accessible?
We found that, yes, it's been happening gradually over the last decade or so. But for most of video game history, accessibility was sort of an afterthought, if it was thought of at all. Probably the biggest development was back in 2020. A company called Naughty Dog released a game called The Last of Us Part 2. This is an action-adventure game where you run, jump, and shoot your way through a sprawling post-apocalyptic world filled with zombies.
You're gonna have to run!
I wouldn't think that would be very accessible for players with hearing, vision, or physical disabilities.
No, it definitely doesn't. But the developers of this game were thinking differently. They had had success making another one of their games easier to play, like just more player-friendly in general. And so they started wondering what other options could they add to a game to make it accessible to even more people, including players with disabilities. They decided to do a lot of experimenting and consulting with gamers with disabilities, and they eventually added more than 60 different accessibility options to the game.
That sounds like a lot. Like, what kinds of things did they add?
Yeah, it's so interesting. It's like players can have the option to reassign what each switch and what each button does, which can be really helpful for players with certain physical disabilities. Players with hearing impairments could turn on visual cues. And then there were options aimed at people with vision-related disabilities, people like Ross Miner.
Growing up, so many blind people, including myself, have developed crazy convoluted ways to play video games.
Ross works as an accessibility consultant and actually specializes in video games. He remembers back when this Pokemon video game was really hot when he was a kid, and even though he couldn't see the screen, he adapted.
I literally went home and got my Game Boy and memorized every single sound in the game just to play alongside my friends.
Over time, Ross figured out how to play other kinds of games, even if they weren't designed with him in mind. But there were certain games that Ross thought he would never be able to play, what some call AAA games. These are your big budget, epic titles with epic storylines that often require players to navigate huge 3D worlds.
I had these thoughts when I was a kid, like, oh, if they added this feature, like, I'd be able to play the game. But it always just seemed like a pipe dream.
And that is until Ross played The Last of Us Part 2, because the game had all these accessibility options for vision-impaired players. There was a screen reader that helped him navigate menus, there was voiceover that described what was going on in scenes, and then lots of sound cues.
Sound cues for when you need to vault over something, when you need to crouch, when you're aiming at an enemy. Like, there's so many different sound cues. It's truly a work of art.
But maybe his favorite feature was an option that allowed a player to send out a sort of sonar pulse in the game.
And then, like, in stereo, you know, it'll play, like, a sound to the left or a sound far off to the right. And then you can track that object and it'll guide you to it. So, yeah, you're literally able to go through the entire game. You're able to collect items and weapons and all of that completely by yourself. I'm not an emotional person, but, like, it literally brought tears to my eyes because something like this was never done before.
I love the idea of making these games more inclusive. Waylon, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing all of this incredible reporting. I know so much more about gaming now, and I get to share all this information with my son.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope you get to the Sherlock Holmes level in the Princess Peach game soon, because it really delivers.
Okay, I'm going to work on that. That's Waylon Wong, co-host of The Indicator from Planet Money. You can hear the rest of our conversation on the video game industry on the Sunday Story podcast. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Maybe this has happened to you. You're driving down the highway, music blasting, or maybe some NPR, and then you see signs for a lane closure ahead. You might be the kind of person who merges as soon as you can into the slow-moving open lane. But then you see those drivers next to you, the ones who breeze by, putting off that merge until the last possible moment. Does this tick you off? Are you sitting there thinking, how rude? Well, it turns out those other drivers might have the right idea. This is called zipper merging, and it's actually encouraged by transportation officials in a lot of states, including the one of our next guest, Marshall Zellinger. He's a reporter with 9 News in Denver, Colorado, where he's been on a bit of a zipper merge education campaign this year, and he joins us to talk about it now. Hi, Marshall.
Hi, Aisha. It's going to be a movement after today. We're going nationwide.
Okay, so did I describe zipper merging correctly?
You did it phenomenally, except from the zipper merge perspective is the people breezing by aren't the rude ones.
Yes, and this is usually for, like, construction zones. What about when there's, like, a busy exit or, like, a car accident when a lane is blocked off, like what we're describing? Zipper merging is waiting until you get as close to that obstruction as possible?
Correct. If your lane is ending, you're still encouraged to take it all the way that you can to help ease congestion behind you. However, if it's an exit lane and you're trying to use the exit lane as far as you can before you swoop back into traffic, that is not a zipper merge. That's being a jerk.
Okay. This is radio, but I do recommend for people who can to look at this on YouTube, because I feel like that will really, seeing the visual really makes it clear. I had to look it up. Is it always more efficient and safer to do the zipper merge?
When traffic is slow because of, like, a construction zone, yes. There is a study that several experts have told me it could ease traffic in that area by 40%.
Well, so other than just educating the public about this driving technique, what else do you think would help drivers get into this habit?
Well, so my idea, make your hand like a peace sign. So everybody put up your, let's say, your right hand, like you're the driver, put up your right hand in front of your rear view mirror. Make the peace sign, and then bring your fingers together.
Like a zipper.
Like a zipper. You've made 2 into 1. We should get the Spice Girls involved. Bring, you know, 2 into 1. And that's my campaign for this, is the more people know about it, the more normal it's going to be. And I'll tell you, we got an email from someone who went to church last weekend and said they were in line for communion two lines, and they both looked at each other at the front of the line, zippered, did the hand signal to each other, and that's the moment I understood I'm literally doing the Lord's work.
We're so grateful. That's Marshall Zellinger of 9 News in Denver talking about zipper merging. Thank you so much, and safe driving and safe zipper merging, Marshall.
Thank you, Aisha, and feel free any weekend to just end the show like, you know, have a good weekend and don't forget to zipper merge.
This is NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from Paint Care. Leftover paint can be dropped off and recycled at nearly 800 sites in California. PaintCare.org.
I'm Guy Marzorati. Next time on Forum at 10 a.m., with its term drawing to a close, the U.S. Supreme Court is set to rule on major issues like abortion access, gun regulations, and whether former President Trump has immunity from civil litigation. We'll look at what the upcoming rulings could mean for the presidential election, the country, and you. That's Forum at 10 a.m. on KQED.
That's tomorrow's Forum at 10 a.m. in the 9 o'clock hour with Alexis Madrigal. Robin Sloan's novel Moonbound expands time, space, and technology. A conversation with Robin Sloan about the power of science fiction and his far-flung imaginings on sentience, collective history, humanity's future, and the remarkable potentials of yeast. That's all coming up in the 9 o'clock hour of tomorrow's Forum.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. President Biden is winding down his state visit to France. The president and first lady were feted at a state dinner in Paris last night, where both nations celebrated their friendship. Today, the Bidens are stopping at an American cemetery outside of Paris. Between eastern Idaho and Jackson, Wyoming, there's a huge gap in the road through the Teton Pass. Officials in the state of Wyoming declare the road had catastrophically failed. It's a critical link between the two states. In horse racing's Belmont Stakes, yet another new Triple Crown race winner, defying 17-1 odds. Dornock pulled ahead of the pack to take the third leg of the Triple Crown by less than a length. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. And Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And the listeners and supporters and members of KQED Public Radio. I'm Beth Heisinger. Good morning. 18 minutes now before 8 o'clock.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe, and it's time to play the puzzle. Joining us is Will Shortz. He's puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition. Hey there, Will.
Good morning, Aisha.
So, Will, will you please remind us of last week's challenge?
Yes, I said, think of a famous writer with a three-word name. I said the first two letters of the last name, followed by the first two letters of the middle name, followed by the first two letters of the first name, would spell an adjective that describes this author today. Who is it? Well, the author is Edgar Rice Burroughs, who's most famous for creating Tarzan. And if you take those letters, you get buried. And Edgar Rice Burroughs, his ashes are indeed buried today.
There were more than 1,400 correct responses. And this week's winner is Carrie Seidman of Cleveland Heights, Ohio. Congratulations, Carrie.
Thank you very much.
So how long have you been playing the puzzle?
Oh, I don't remember ever sending in postcards, but I've been sending in the entries online probably 10 years.
Okay, and you have a connection to NPR, but that's not how you got on here. You taught a beloved reporter here at NPR. Is that correct?
Yes, I did. The health and medicine reporter, Selena Simmons Duffin, was in my class for 2 years in seventh and eighth grade.
And you were a middle school science teacher for how many years?
50.
50 years. That is a commitment.
Yes, yes,
we thank you for that.
Okay.
Are you ready to play the puzzle?
I think so.
Okay, take it away, Will.
Yeah, Carrie, I know you're ready for this. Also, Aisha, every answer today is a word or name ending in net in any spelling. For example, if I said a small room in which to eat meals, you would say dinette. Here's number one, a person with brown hair.
Brunette.
That's right. An old crime show with a catchphrase, just the facts, ma'am.
Dragnet.
That's right. A puppet manipulated by strings.
Marionette.
That's it. A soldier's weapon used for stabbing.
Bayonet.
Uh-huh. A wind instrument akin to an oboe.
Oh, I'm thinking cornet, but I don't think that's right.
Hold that answer for later.
Okay. Okay, what's another?
Looks like it's a reed instrument that sort of looks like an oboe.
Clarinet.
Clarinet is right. How about a brass instrument related to the trumpet?
Now we'll do cornet.
There's your cornet. A percussion instrument that a dancer clicks.
Castanet.
You got it. Old French queen Marie Blanc.
Antoinette.
That's it. Singer Tammy.
Wynette.
That's it. Here's a little, this goes back a ways. Blank Rankin. She was the first woman in Congress.
Jeanette Rankin.
Excellent. Blank Funicello, one of TV's original Mouseketeers.
Sure. Annette.
Very good. Comedian Carol.
Burnett.
Okay, here's a little bit of trivia. President Joe Biden's middle name.
Robinette.
Excellent. Newspaper chain that publishes USA Today.
I don't know that one.
Do you know this, Aisha?
Yeah, Gannett.
Gannett is it?
Gannett, yeah. Okay.
How about villainous superintelligence system in the Terminator films?
Don't know that one either.
I bet you know this one, Aisha.
Yeah. Skynet.
Skynet, good job. Here's your last one, something a baby sleeps in.
A bassinet.
You got it. Nice job.
Well, you did a great job. How do you feel?
Fine. It was fun. A lot of fun.
For playing our puzzle today, you'll get a weekend edition lapel pin as well as puzzle books and games. You can read all about it at npr.org/puzzle. And Carrie, what member station do you listen to?
We are longtime members of WKSU.
Glad to hear that. That's Carrie Seidman of Cleveland Heights, Ohio. Thanks for playing the puzzle.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, Will, what's next week's challenge?
Yes, it comes from listener Patrick McIntyre of Seattle, and it's a little tricky. What item containing a silent U is commonly found in kitchen drawers? So that's the puzzle. What item containing a silent U is commonly found in kitchen drawers?
When you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle, and click on the Submit Your Answer link. Remember, just one entry, please. Our deadline for entries this week is Thursday, June 13th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Don't forget to include a phone number where we can reach you. If you're the winner, we'll give you a call. And if you pick up the phone, you'll get to play on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition, Will Shortz. Thank you, Will.
Thanks a lot, Aisha.
Romance is big business in publishing, a rare bright spot in adult fiction sales. Think Colleen Hoover, Emily Henry, Jasmine Guillory. So why did the Romance Writers of America, the trade group supporting romance writers, recently file for bankruptcy? Andrew Limbong joins us now. He's the host of NPR's Book of the Day podcast. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Aisha.
So quick step back. Tell us more about the role of the Romance Writers of America, or RWA.
Well, it's a trade organization, and it started in 1980 by Vivian Stevens, who was an editor of romance books. She's Black, by the way, which will be, you know, important later on. Anyway, she got together with a bunch of romance writers and formed this group to support authors, you know, mostly women, who were working in this genre that, you know, just didn't get as much respect as, you know, like literary fiction, right? So every year they'd hold these conferences across the country, which was like a great way to network, you know, like meet other writers and like learn some skills about like writing as a business. And at its peak, you know, around 2019, the group had nearly 10,000 members, which is huge for an org like that.
So what happened?
Well, you know, they just kept getting caught in these multiple accusations over racism. So like in 2018, fans and members pointed out that no Black author had ever won their big award, which is known as the RITA. You know, the RWA came out of it saying, we're committed to inclusivity and promise to do better. Then in 2019, it got caught in another scandal when it censured one of its own members for going online and criticizing a book written by a fellow RWA author as being racist. And, you know, this, of course, led to a huge blow up online, and the RWA had to put out another statement saying it was canceling the RITAs and it was going to hire a DEI consultant. According to the bankruptcy filing, the RWA's handling of these racism accusations is what caused its membership to just plummet. It's now at like 3,000 members.
Oh, wow. And I'm guessing that had to hurt the bottom line.
Yeah, exactly. And in 2019, when they're at the peak of their powers, they'd gotten into these contracts with various Marriott hotels around the country to host their annual conferences. Of course, then, you know, like COVID happened. But then, you know, the organization managed to squeak on by. They had their last annual conference in 2023, but then just bills came due.
So what's been the reaction from the romance world?
I think mixed, you know, there's a decent amount of like good riddance type sentiment out there that like maybe we'd just be better off starting over. But I talked to Jayashree Kamble. She's an English professor at LaGuardia Community College and is an expert in mass market romance. And she actually got some funding from the RWA to do research work. And she says she and her fellow academics watched all of this go down with some amount of sadness.
Because there is and was so much valuable work that the RWA did, especially for women who maybe otherwise would not have been able to break through. But we always have to be conscious that every organization that is maybe doing something good for some folks may not be doing the same for some other folks.
And I want to add that the RWA filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, which is the, like, I'm going to restructure my debt to figure out a way out of this plan versus the, like, here's all my assets to liquidate. So there might even be a future here for the RWA.
So what would that even look like?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. There's a lot of goodwill and cultural cachet in the romance sphere that the org will need to work to regain. And I don't know if it has the juice to pull it off.
That was NPR's Andrew Limbong. Andrew, thanks so much.
Thanks, Aisha.
Sturgill Simpson has made a big name for himself in music.
Says my son, it's all been done. Someday gonna wake up old and gray.
But the country star announced he's releasing a new album and heading out on tour. Not as himself, but as Johnny Blue Skies. It got us to thinking about musical alter egos, when musicians adopt different names, maybe personalities too, to release their music. So we're bringing in Stephen Thompson of NPR Music. He has all the answers. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, Aisha.
Do you want to adopt a different persona for this interview?
I'm actually speaking to you as... I should have had a joke for this. I don't have a good NPR name. You know, people always talk about NPR names.
And like Stephen Fancy Pants.
Yeah, Stephen Fancy like, Pants. Yes. I like to think of myself as Stephen Fancy Pants. I might as well actually make it part of my professional life.
Well, let's set some ground rules. How do you define a musical alter ego? Because obviously... You know, a lot of musicians go by names that aren't actually their birth names, like Lady Gaga, Elton John, Queen Latifah. Like, that's not the names they were
born with.
For this assignment, I sort of thought about it in terms of people who have established musical personas like Sturgill Simpson and then have decided to pivot into presenting themselves under a different name. And some musicians have a long history of this where almost every album is coming out from a different persona. You think of somebody like David Bowie or Cool Keith. But I was really thinking of it as like a career pivot.
Okay.
You know, where like the country singer Garth Brooks was rolling along, one of the biggest stars in the world, one of the best-selling artists of all time, and all of a sudden he puts out a pop record from a different version of himself named Chris Gaines.
But there's something about you when you're around, baby, I have found I get lost in you.
That's not bad. I hadn't heard that before. That's not bad. I like that.
Garth Brooks is a talented guy. I mean, that record sometimes gets used as a punchline because he was just at the absolute height of his fame and all of a sudden put out this record that was not necessarily going to be super palatable to country fans. But, like, that's a perfect example of somebody who contains multitudes. He didn't want to just sound like one guy. He wanted to try his hand at a different style of music that interested him.
Give us some classic examples of musical alter egos.
Well, I think David Bowie is one of the first names that you think of. David Bowie, you know, I probably most famously deployed the persona of Ziggy Stardust, mm-hmm. you know, this kind of intergalactic figure, but he was also Aladdin Sane. He was also the Thin White Duke. He was somebody who toyed with a lot of different versions of himself.
There's a starman waiting in the sky.
You know, and that's a great example of, like, he's performing as Ziggy Stardust, but everyone knows it's David Bowie, right?
Yeah.
So it falls into the category, but he wasn't necessarily presenting himself as, like, don't call me David Bowie anymore.
Okay. Do we have any of those where people, like, really, like, they really change themselves and, like, this is my new persona, this is me now?
Well, one example that springs to my mind is the artist Father John Misty.
Am I its bread and butter?
Like, who put out a bunch of records under the name Jay Tillman. His name is Josh Tillman. And at some point, kind of a ways into his career, I think he felt himself stagnating a little bit and rebranded himself as Father John Misty, who is kind of this larger-than-life figure, and wrote his songs and albums from the perspective of this character. And at that point, his career really took off. Now, a lot of Father John Misty fans probably don't even necessarily think of him as Josh Tillman. They think of him as Father John Misty, this character.
Mm. So it sounds like the reasons for doing this would be maybe to liberate yourself,
yeah,
if you feel like you're stuck in one zone, or to kind of put some more juice into your career.
Yeah, I also think I would add one other category, which is changing the stakes. In general, songwriting is an empathy exercise, right? A songwriter is constantly putting themselves in the brain, in the mind, in the life of another person. And so it only makes sense that a really creative songwriter would want to toy with not only looking at the world through someone else's eyes, but envisioning themselves as a different artist. I think it's a natural phenomenon, and that's why it's come up over and over and over again throughout the entire history of popular music.
Do you have an all-time musical alter ego favorite we can go out on?
You know what? I'm always going to want to shine a little light on the Traveling Wilburys. Those records meant so much to me as like a teenager and a young adult. And the Traveling Wilburys was a super group of Bob Dylan, Tom Petty, Jeff Lynne, Roy Orbison, and George Harrison. And, you know, those are five artists with massive followings, with extraordinarily successful careers, but they wanted to do a record that felt, I think, smaller to them and that allowed them to kind of work with their friends and play around with this really collegial, lower stakes sound. There's this beautiful, beautiful song, End of the Line, that just feels like an accumulation of a whole bunch of really warm-hearted and hard-won wisdom. Let's go on an End of the Line.
Oh, this is good. I didn't know this was them.
Oh, this song is so good-hearted.
That's Stephen Thompson of NPR Music. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Aisha.
You can sit around and wait for the phone to ring. Waiting for someone to tell you everything.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at MacFound.org. And the listeners of KQED. Good morning. I'm Beth Heisinger. We're going to do a traffic check now. There's a crash in Richmond. Here's Lori Sanders to tell you more about it.
And it's a busy morning. Richmond, eastbound 80 before Richmond Parkway. It's a three-vehicle crash. Two cars are blocking the three right lanes. The other is on the shoulder. But CHP is on scene, and they're blocking the three right lanes so they can do a traffic break back at El Portal. Traffic is stopped back to Hilltop Drive. In Vallejo, westbound 37 before Wilson, it's a motorhome on fire over on the right-hand shoulder. We've got emergency crews on scene.